All right. So you ready to get started?
Sure. Let's do it.
Okay. Why don't you first start out telling me a little bit about Tuatara Capital. Did I pronounce it right?
You did, yes.
Yeah. And like the type of companies you focus on and what you look for in a company.
Sure. So Tuatara Capital is the largest, single largest 3C1 private equity fund that exists in the space dedicated specifically to cannabis. Mm-hmm. So we are, been in business now for about 18 months as far as, you know, being out to market and raising the fund. We're actually done with fundraising or done with raising the entire fund at the end of next week. I'm sure you're familiar with the Jobs Act regulations. We can't really discuss fundraising in an interview for general solicitation purposes.
Yes.
But we are the largest pool of capital that currently exists in the cannabis industry.
Mm-hmm.
What we look for in companies are within four discrete subsectors of the industry. We only focus on groups that are based in the science side, so the research and testing side of the industry, really the traditional FDA pathway for either biotech or pharma.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also look at the state-regulated medicinal side. So we look at the large-scale commercial cultivators that are producing in large-scale greenhouses or looking to produce those sort of row crops. And then we also look at the very small boutique cultivators, but we avoid the middle market. We don't like anyone that's doing large-scale commercial warehouses because we think they can't compete on price with the greenhouses. We don't think they can compete on quality with the boutique guys. So we're on either end of the barbell on cultivation.
Mm-hmm.
We concentrate on the processors. Those are the groups that are extracting cannabinoids from the plant for repackaging in non-smoking products, whether it's topical, salves, transdermal patches, sublingual strips, anything that's a non-smoked variety that's not oil-based. And those are really, we look at as the first, you know, true brands that are going to come out of the cannabis space. And then finally, downstream, in the later half of our fund cycle, we'll be focused on consumer retail operations. So it's states that allow for, you know, widespread proliferation of retail,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, as you know, in a lot of the northeastern states, there's very few licensed operators, but a lot of the western states, there's more. States that have the opportunity to do a sort of a wholesale roll-up to build an enviable consumer retail experience. We're looking about 4 years down the road to deploying capital in that space as well.
Wow. Okay. So you're in quite a few areas.
We're actually not in a lot of the areas. We don't touch paraphernalia. We don't touch real estate. We don't touch financial services. We don't do consumer software. We don't do, I can give you a whole host of the things we don't touch. You know, we don't do picks and shovels like all the cultivation equipment. We don't do, far more opportunities we turn down just categorically. And then even in the places that we do like them, for instance, we would never touch a cultivation in California. We don't think the regulatory is strong enough to provide any sort of security or comfort around investing in the California market as it's currently written. You know, same is true of overly restricted states such as like New York or Minnesota. We won't touch those either because we don't think they have a large enough program to make it worthwhile to invest because we don't think we can get a return on the investment. So we're very, very narrowly focused as far as, you know, what we do in the industry and then where we do it within those subsectors.
Yeah, well, speaking of California, you know, we have the ballot issue coming up in the November election. Mm-hmm. What do you think are the chances of it passing?
I think far better than they ever have been before. I think this is try number three for California for adult use recreational legalization. And I think that the last two times it's on the ballot, you didn't have the support of the cannabis industry at all.
Mm-hmm.
I think this time, you know, you're actually seeing the northern county producing counties, whether, you know, the Humboldt, the Mendocino, Trinity, really getting behind this initiative. Now, you know, does that really matter population-wise? No one lives there. Who cares?
Yeah.
But, you know, when you think about what the prevailing belief is now down in the more conservative parts of the state, like Orange County, you're starting to see a great deal more traction than you ever have before. And you've got the Lieutenant Governor championing the piece of legislation. You've got guys like Sean Parker that are putting capital behind it. There isn't all that much opposition to it as far as well-defined opposition. So I would expect that you're going to see California pass adult use recreational this year.
Wow. Okay. Now, you mentioned that you stay out of the financial side, you know, of the industry. And from my understanding is that currently the growers and dispensaries operate on a cash basis, since the banks and credit card companies don't want to deal with the industry. Do you see this changing?
Well, it already has. I mean, the IRS made a report last year that 266 financial institutions actually are banking cannabis-based companies right now.
Okay.
So a lot of the media hype that you're seeing around lack of transactional banking is largely a fiction at this point. Now, in California, it's totally true, because in California, again, the banks don't trust that there's being, you know, precautions being taken by the operators to make sure there's nothing illicit happening even on a state level. So, you know, from the bank's perspective, it's all about the KYC rules, the AML and KYC rules.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, and they don't want to spend their time filing SARS reports.
Yeah.
So if you actually have a company that's well-defined in the regulatory scheme, that is one that they can trust, banks are willing to bank a cannabis-based company. They just need to know that your management team is a real management team. You have the ability to do what they're looking for, and that you're not a high risk.
Mm-hmm.
You can prove that to a financial institution, they'll bank you. Now, on the credit card side, you're absolutely right, because, you know, credit cards operate neatly in 50 states that, you know, are national in nature. A transaction can pass between you know, different portions of areas that don't have legal cannabis laws.
Mm-hmm.
There's issues there. Most of the credit card companies, the way their pathways and gateways are set up, aren't able to work with the cannabis industry. Now, the second part of your question is, do I see that changing? Yeah, that's exactly why we're not interested in that side of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our expectations in the next 2 years, based on all guidance that we're receiving from the federal government, that the Treasury Department is going to make a wholesale overhaul of what's allowed to be done with cannabis-based businesses. And when they do, you know, you get groups like Bank of America, Wells and Chase, they're sitting on the sidelines just salivating.
Mm-hmm.
And the second they can come in, they're coming in. So do I think that I'm smart enough or have a team smart enough that I can fund that is going to be able to come up with a better mousetrap than the infrastructure that's already in place for the multinational financial institution? I don't think there's a chance.
Mm-hmm.
So why would I, you know, allocate resources to something that I think is going to be solved for on its own, and then I'm competing against behemoths? It just doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I have a question that I've asked several people, you know, in the industry, and I haven't really gotten an answer that I'm sure is correct. And, you know, marijuana has been illegal for so long, and it just makes me wonder, who are the lobbyists that are behind it? Is the pharmaceutical companies, the private prison companies, the law enforcement, cigarette companies? I mean, is there somebody or some group that's really been behind this for so long, or is it...
Right. Who's sitting behind the curtain pulling strings?
Yes.
Okay, so let's go back, and again, I apologize, this is a bit more of a history lesson and a longer answer than you're looking for, but if you look at the history of illegality with cannabis, starting off with Henry Anslinger back in 1937 and going up to the Nixon administration in the early 1970s, essentially a lot of the reason that cannabis was made illegal in the first place was fear-mongering back in the 30s against jazz musicians and against immigrants coming over from Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
So when it was first attracted the ire of the federal government, it was in reaction to not having alcohol anymore to point a finger at, and it was looking for a new villain, and cannabis was it at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Now, going forward, you know, if you read all the history of what happened from 1937 to, you know, 1970, it just became more draconian because of different sentencing laws and because, you know, things that are different. Act, stand back, the rest of it. Now, in the early 1970s, the Nixon administration came in, and at the time you were dealing with hippies, you were dealing with Vietnam, and they created the CSA, which is the Controlled Substances Act. They placed cannabis on Schedule 1 as a placeholder. They didn't believe that cannabis would stay on Schedule 1, because Schedule 1 is, you know, it's no medicinal benefit and a high potential for abuse.
Mm-hmm.
So, when it was placed there, what Nixon did is hired a independent study to be conducted by the federal government specific to whether or not, you know, cannabis should remain on Schedule 1 or where it should be placed, you know, what the relative harm of the substance was. And the commission came back, and this is well documented, it was actually released about 10 years ago from the Freedom of Information Act, and the commission came back and said, we don't think cannabis should be placed in the CSA at all. It should be, you know, it's completely delisted, it's a rather innocuous substance, there's no known overdose, it's a non-toxic product, etc. suppress that study almost instantaneously and left it on the Schedule 1 as a result. And that sort of, that was the watershed moment that has kept cannabis where it is for the next 40-plus years. And the reason being is once it's on Schedule 1, it's deemed to have been asked and answered already. You know, we looked at it, we made a determination. At this point, because there, we'd say no medicinal value, then clinical trials are not allowed to be conducted. So if you're a research university or you're a biotech and you actually want to conduct a clinical trial on cannabis-based medicines, there is no place to apply. You know, you could contact NIDA or you can contact the FDA and they'd say, sorry guys, we've made the determination that cannabis is completely illegal. Now that changed back when the Randall happened down at the Supreme Court back in the 70s. And that was a medical necessity, a case that was put forward by a gentleman named Randall, who said, you need to survive in my ability to you know, treat a condition. And as a result, he won the case, and the federal government came up with a program that now resides at the University of Mississippi, the Ole Miss program. And that's the only place that you're allowed to legally grow cannabis in the United States by, you know, according to the federal government. And what they did is create a program that if you applied for it as a patient, you were certified, and at one time there's close to 100 patients certified, then you were able to access cannabis, and they'd send you a jar of joints every month. What happened is that they eventually had a sunset provision on that program, and as people started to die off, because most of them had, you know, terminal illnesses, they didn't accept any patients into the program. So the Ole Miss program pretty much fell into disarray, literally until about 2 or 3 years ago, when they started reopening it, because there's so much of an outcry saying, well, come on, we need to start studying this plant, this is insane. So there isn't any industry per se. It wasn't, you know, you think the regular, the usual suspects of like pharmaceutical, tobacco, and alcohol would all be trying to protect market share, would try to do whatever they can to suppress this. And again, I think your analogy of the private prison lobby, certainly without a doubt, it's in the best interest of the prison community and of rehabs in general. I mean, rehabs, they get so many people remanded to their facilities by judges who say, you know, as part of your sentencing, you know, we'll give you a deferred sentence, but you know, you need to spend 6 months in an inpatient rehabilitation center. But that's why you hear every rehab person will talk about the addiction of cannabis. You know, even though there's no proven addiction rate of cannabis, the only people that ever talk about it are the guys that run rehabs. That's because they're protecting their market share. Oh yeah, I've treated all sorts of cannabis addicts. So are those guys pulling strings? Is it as nefarious as you might think? Probably not. But what's happened is that because of the scheduling and schedule to start with, it's been near impossible to be removed from that list, and as a result, it's been near impossible to have any movement. So it's really taken a state-by-state kind of Tenth Amendment standpoint to progress the issue. But it wasn't because, you know, Dow and DuPont and a few other chemical companies, you know, were protecting the ability, or, you know, people talk about the Hearst, you know, Foundation back in the old days of protecting their timber purchases to make paper pulp instead of hemp pulp. All that's nonsense, as far as I know. So it really is. Based on the fact that, you know, it was politically unpopular for years to be soft on drugs and soft on crime. And after 1986, when Len Bias died from a cocaine overdose and the Reagan administration was saying, just say no, they doubled down on the war on drugs. And as a result, cannabis was caught up in that war alongside every other harder drug. And it's taken, you know, the last 30 years to start on tying that knot.
Do you think there's a good chance that it'll eventually be removed from all schedules in the near future?
No, not THC, which is the psychoactive component to cannabis. I expect that will remain on some schedule. I think the other phytocannabinoids that are proven to be non-psychotropic or non-psychoactive, those will be removed because there's no reason to keep them on the CSA. But as far as THC, I mean, without a doubt, THC is a mind-altering substance. So can you completely remove it? Probably not. But do I think it'll be, you know, declassified or, you know, reclassified to a lower schedule, Schedule 3 perhaps, which is where Marinol is, which is synthetic THC? It's hard for me to understand how a synthetic is scheduled two schedules lower than the natural version of the same thing. So I would expect you're going to see cannabis, THC as a phytocannabinoid eventually end up in Schedule 3. But I certainly don't think that it's going to be delisted completely anytime in the near future. I think you might have a carve-out where it's treated like alcohol on a state-by-state basis. It'll be up to states to make self-determination on what they want to do with adult-use recreational cannabis. Mm-hmm. But on the pharmaceutical side, as a molecule, no, I think it's going to remain.
Huh. Okay. Do you have any opinion on the publicly traded cannabis stocks?
Sure. How candid do you want me to be?
As candid as you'd like.
I think that a lot of the publicly traded cannabis stocks have no business being on the public markets. I think that a lot of them were enticed into being on the public markets through a reverse merge onto the OTC by an investor that said, you know, this is the best way for you guys to have true liquidity and sold management teams into a bill of goods that they shouldn't have bought into.
Mm-hmm.
Not understanding what the reporting requirements are of being a publicly traded company, not understanding that, you know, you need to be able to make your stock move. And at that point, most of these companies just end up taking death spiral toxic debt and have so much derivative debt on their books that they're never going to climb out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said that, there's probably some decent companies that are out there on the OTC. There's certainly a few, you know, that I really like that I think have really good management teams and have a real shot at uplisting downstream when the SEC allows for it. But the vast majority of them made a mistake by taking themselves out.
Mm-hmm. Well, kind of as a follow-up to that question, now with the you know, the change in the Jobs Act about non-accredited investors, do you see that investment crowdfunding is going to be used for marijuana-related companies?
You talking about Reg A Plus filings?
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if they're allowed to. I know that recently there was a crowdfunding initiative that was shut down that was tied to cannabis.
Yeah.
I don't think that's going to continue. I mean, I think that you'll see Reg A filings become more and more popular as a means of raising capital for small cannabis-based businesses, but no more so than I think you see in any other industry.
I see. Okay. I saw in an article that, and I don't know if you can talk about this or not, but your company's getting involved with Willie Nelson's brand of cannabis. Is there anything you can say about that? Or
sure. We saw the opportunity of working with an icon in the cannabis industry that has the ability to market a product line across all 50 states, even has states are not online yet, that is able to, Willie has been probably one of the most recognizable figures in the fight against the tyranny of prohibition in cannabis for the last 50 years.
Mm-hmm.
And as a result has gained a following across all walks of life and all age groups of being an icon in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the opportunity to work with someone like Willie and the team that Willie's put together as a great opportunity of building one of the first great American cannabis brands.
Mm-hmm.
In the same vein as, you know, Paul Newman did with you know, initially salad dressing and a whole host of other products. We just see that the Willie Nelson name in cannabis is one of the most marketable names you're going to come across.
Hmm. Okay. This is kind of a side question, but I know that the Money Show in San Francisco is having an all-day event on cannabis investing. Are you going to be speaking there at all, or anyone from your company, do you know?
No, I'm not. I know the gals are putting that on pretty well. They've asked me to speak at different things that they've done in the past, including their Shark Tank TV show.
Uh-huh.
But no, it's not for us. It's more, most of the things that we do are more on the level of just speaking at, you know, YPO or WPO events, or speaking at biotech events, or speaking at an event like that. To be a speaker normally requires a financial commitment to the organizers.
Uh-huh.
And we don't pay to speak at events.
I see.
So we won't be here.
Okay. Do you have any advice for an investor who's looking to allocate some money towards the cannabis industry?
Yes. Read the legislation in whatever state you're in and know it cold. Do not think that every state is the same. There's nuances in every state. Every state operates in a vacuum. And for you to make an investment, just because your friend is successful investing in Oregon doesn't mean you'll be successful investing in New York. You must learn the regs.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any advice for anyone that wants to create a startup in the cannabis industry?
Make sure you're very well capitalized, and make sure that you know it is that you're trying to start. Don't taking an opportunistic approach in this space doesn't work. You need to be laser focused around who your market is going to be, who your end consumer is going to be, what your exit strategy is going to be. You have to go into it with your eyes wide open that it's more complicated than any other industry based on the different nuances of the law, and that every state is different. So if you're going to make a decision to enter the cannabis industry, spend the requisite amount of time to develop your business model well in advance of starting.
Great. Okay, well, that was basically all the questions I had for you. If anyone wants to learn more about your company, is there a website they should go to? Or
yes, there is. Tuatarcapital.com is the best place to go.
And that's spelled TUATARACAPITAL.com. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
All right. Well, I really appreciate your time. This has been really informative, and thanks very much for speaking to us.
Yeah, my pleasure. And the only thing I would ask is that when you do publish, just send a copy over to Evan and Ethan so they can get a copy over to us. And
okay.
That's all we need.
All right, great. Thanks again.
My pleasure. Thank you. Enjoy your day.
Okay, you too. Bye.